Welcome to Still Steeping, a podcast where we learn life lessons one cup at a time. I'm one of your hosts, Kelly. I'm joined by the effervescent, radiant beam of light straight from heaven or down below. Who can say? Chris.
Who can say? Hello, hello. It be me, that radiant questioning beam, Chris. Thanks for joining our show, where we seek to have conversations that stimulate the mind and soothe the soul with artists, entrepreneurs, and humans from all walks and stages of life.
Yes, we are finding the movers, the shakers, the feelers, and the thinkers, both locally sourced and from all around this creepy world.
And we are inviting them to our table for a nice cup of, insert something clever here. So join us for some good times, good vibes, and even better humans as we discuss struggles, triumphs, and the overall beauty of finding and understanding oneself through the pursuit of what really makes your life move to the true rhythm of your soul. Hi, Still Steeping fam, and welcome back to another episode. Today, we have an interview with the multi-talented Trey Steinhoff.
Trey is a lot of things, and that's how he likes it. Mm-hmm. Professionally, he could be described as an entrepreneur, product manager, marketer, designer, event planner, nonprofit founder, and activist.
Ugh, the man cannot be stopped. And as a creative, he has also tackled print, digital, and clothing design, as well as photography, videography, painting, and multimedia mashups.
What he wants you to know about him is that he's doing his best to make things that don't suck and to inspire people along the way.
And he has been doing just that, especially in his ability to inspire me over the past couple of months. The impact that this recent social revolution has had on him and his response has been a big inspiration for me. Through him, I've seen what stepping into being a true white ally can look like.
We talked to Trey about his creative journey of finding his ikigai and how he can use his talents and inherent understanding of his privilege to actively engage in anti-racist work.
Yes. And important to mention here, Trey and I have been best friends for the past 10 years, and we currently work and live together.
So, like, what you're saying is you're basically domestic partners?
No comment. No, but in all seriousness, in this episode, we also discuss what growing up as outsiders in an affluent community and how that shared experience has different impacts on each of us relating to our understanding of race and racial issues.
We also discuss concrete ways we can engage as white allies in our communities and especially in our interpersonal relationships.
This episode, guys, is packed full of nuggets and little words of wisdom and how we can actively be a part of this discussion and conversation that's happening in our lives right now. We hope that you enjoy and that you take away something like we did. So without further ado, here is Trey Steinhoff.
I don't know why I always want to do that.
Live your best life. We are here with the wonderful, incredible, amazing, fantastical, any other words I can make up, Trey Steinhoff. Trey Steinhoff.
Hello. Hello, hello, Trey. Hi.
How's it going? Hi.
It's going pretty good, man. It's going pretty good. We're very excited about this. For our audience here, we had an interview with Trey a little bit ago, and it was before all the craziness of the George Floyd and the social revolution that we're having. And as a result, Trey actually reached out to us and was like, hey, I want to redo this interview because I got shit to say.
We have more pressing matters.
Yeah. So for the audience, we're probably going to air his other interview maybe later on in the series and in the season. But so we decided to jump back on here and get Trey on here and kind of evaluate our current climate and what's going on. So that being said, Trey, just a brief kind of like how you're doing. Obviously, we're going to go into more detail, but like, how are you?
Right on. Well, I poured the coffee grounds into the water section of the coffee maker today. So,
it's been
a rough couple months, but
he needs it extra strong. Is what he's saying. He's fired up.
I feel that.
No, but really, just like the coffee maker, you got to take extra time to clean out the basin that you're drinking from. And so, essentially, I'm doing as well as I can be in this moment in American history, I guess. I have a job and a house and I'm healthy, question mark. I mean, I had the virus. I had coronavirus confirmed, but I didn't have to go to the hospital. So, and you know, at the end of the day, I'm a straight white dude. So it's, I'm doing well. But I'm emotionally wrought, I would say.
Heard that. Yes, we both did have the virus. I agree with you 100% in terms of just like being thankful for all the things that we do have, which is super important, like job, especially in this climate with Corona and furloughs, having a house, being relatively healthy. But the emotional tax that I think this time period has had on a lot of people cannot be overstated enough. That being said, I think one of the things that we were talking about with all of our guests, and we kind of go into it a little bit in that other episode that we recorded, but depending on what we do with it, the people might not hear it. So we're going to start fresh here and kind of talk to you about the Ikigai diagram, right? The Ikigai concept. And for our listeners who might be listening for the first time, Ikigai is a Japanese concept that loosely translated means reason for being. And there's a great little diagram that we have. It'll be in our show notes. It's also on our Instagram at stillsteepingpod, if you guys want to check that out. It's going to be the basis for a lot of our conversations with our guests. And Ikigai is spelled I-K-I-G-A-I. And essentially, the way that the diagram is set up is Ikigai is in the center, so you're trying to get to that point. But everything around it is this idea that to find that balance or to find that reason for being, you need to identify what you love, what the world needs, what you can be paid for, and what you're good at. And within all that, when you find like what you're good at and what you love, that becomes your passion. What you love and what the world needs becomes your mission. What the world needs and what you can be paid for becomes your vocation. And what you can be paid for and what you're good at becomes your profession. And when you kind of can identify and find all these things, all of them kind of lead into your Ikigai or your reason for being, right? So Trey, with that, what do you think about this concept? And also, where do you feel that you land? Obviously, the idea is to land in all of them and find the balance of it. So kind of walk us through where you're at with the concept as a whole.
Yeah, I think that my answer today is the same as it was in our first podcast recording. I think that I'm doing something that I love to do. I love to do a lot of things, truthfully. I feel fortunate that I enjoy doing so many things, and that professionally, what I can be paid for, right? I get to design, I get to problem solve, I get to make strategy, I get to work directly with people. I have a lot of autonomy where I get to make stuff. And at the end of the day, that's all I really care about doing with my time, is learning and making stuff and then helping people. And so I think I'm doing what I love. I think I'm doing what I can be paid for. I know that I'm good at it. Obviously, I can always get better. But the last part, am I doing something that helps people? Am I doing what the world needs? Professionally, I don't think I am. I think that our job, Chris also works at the same company, but this company, it makes tools that help breweries and bars and restaurants. And, you know, those are good things. I think alcohol is
probably like net neutral on the world in terms of an impact, right? A lot of people abuse it, but a lot of people find a lot of joy in it. A lot of like our most memorable occasions in life have alcohol at the table. And I don't think it's inherently bad, but I also don't think it's inherently good. And so I don't think that I'm making tools that are really helping people. I don't think I'm using my talents and what I love to do to make an impact professionally. That said, trying to supplement it. And I think that ties in to the more pressing conversation, which is what can all of us be doing at this exceptional moment in American history?
Yeah, and you've been working with the Black Lives Matter movement to create, using your skill as a graphic designer, to create a lot of really important infographics. I'm looking at your recent one that you made regarding the Tampa General Fund budget. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and how you are using your craft to fulfill that higher purpose and fulfill that other part of the ikigai that you have been missing?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think that everybody has like a role to play in moments like these. And I remember I was at a talk about environmentalism in the Tampa Bay area. And Chris was actually there, and he asked a question about, you know, what he could do after a panel discussion that was really insightful and curated by a friend of ours. Everybody in that room was feeling a little bit of despair. They were feeling a sense of urgency. They were feeling like they needed to figure out a way to contribute to the solution to fight climate change and to fight all of these negative consequences that will happen. And Chris's question was, well, what the hell can I do about this? Mm-hmm. And somebody gave a really good answer. I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but he said something that at a glance seemed a little trite and cliche, but it was, you should be doing the thing that you're best at and point it at the cause. And, you know, for Chris, Chris could write and he could speak about it because he's gifted at those things. And that contribution matters. And so carrying that thought forward, I'm somebody who graduated with a degree in economics, and I'm somebody that has designed a million infographics and a million brands, and I'm somebody that has been paid to read through legal documents before, and I'm somebody who cares about these topics. I'm somebody that has like carried a lot of righteous fury since I was a small boy, right? And
wee little lad.
And so this infographic is really just, it is the position that I'm in. It is the skills that I have manifested into something that is relevant for a very pressing movement in our lives and in our communities and in our country. And so the experience was satisfying in that way. And it was important, and it just, there was an innate sense of urgency about it.
Yeah. I know you and I have talked a lot about this, and in that same vein of, I like where you're at with the ikigai and in that journey for finding that reason for being. And you just stated that where you think you really land is like, are you doing what the world needs? And that's kind of influenced kind of where you're at with your choices and how you're engaging. So I guess the question becomes, how do you break down the social revolution that we're having and its overall impact on your journey towards understanding that reason for being?
Yeah, I think that this civil rights movement, social revolution, more broadly, I think that our democracy is going through like a real test right now, which we can talk more about. Mm-hmm. But those topics are a few of many things that the world needs. Right? The world needs clean water. Right? The world needs equality across a whole lot of different groups of people. The policing issue in the United States is one of many ways you can make a positive contribution. And so I think maybe the answer to your question is, in my personal pursuit of finding ikigai or something that fulfills me in a bunch of different ways and helps other people, we're living in a moment in American history that has a sense of urgency about it. that I think I should be pointed at, and I think that a lot of people should be focused on, but not everybody has to. A lot of people can do what the world needs in their own ways. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. I think another big part that I think it ties into this is you're a white man, and you know, we've known each other for years. And one of the things that I've been talking to you about and a lot of people about is this revolution that we're going through. It's been very interesting to see the impact of it through sort of a white perspective. Like for me as a black man, like I've been experiencing all these issues for a majority of my life in different impactful ways and in different degrees throughout that time frame. But for the most part, this wasn't new to me. When this revolution started, it was just another reminder of an existence that I've already been living. But us being roommates and living through this experience together in this house, it was almost like I was watching you as a white male come to terms with a thing that you've probably understood and known, but it was so much more visceral for you now because of just how pervasive and how strongly it's been in the media. It's been nonstop. Like everywhere you turn, it's here. You lost the ability and the option or the privilege to kind of step aside from it, the same way that a black individual, a person of color, like we don't get to stop being black. And so one of the privileges that I like to talk to my white friends about is that like it's hard to understand the black perspective as a white person because it's inherently, it's nonstop and we don't get to turn it off. But I think one of the benefits or silver lining of all this craziness is that for white allies, you get this opportunity to get as close to understanding as you might because of how just in our face it's been and how nonstop it's been. So can you talk to us about that perspective for you, how this revolution has allowed you to come to terms with your privilege, to understand your privilege a little bit more and your white perspective?
Yeah, for sure. I think that your points about it no longer can be ignored is really relevant, and I agree with it. At least that's how I feel. But that said, there's a lot of people out there that are ignoring it, or maybe they're not ignoring it. They're just not consuming the kind of content that would make them understand it. And I think, you know, for me personally, I was lucky to meet you when I did. We both went to a high school that had BMWs owned by 16-year-olds in the parking lot, yep. Right? Uh-huh. And it's like my family had to go to the church to help us pay for me to go to that school. And
same.
So it's like I didn't have a car when I was in high school. My parents weren't rich, but I was surrounded by all these rich ass white kids. And if I hadn't met you, Chris, like if we hadn't formed a relationship, I would have had like this massive blind spot. There are so many kids at our school that did and might still have that blind spot. And there's a lot of Americans that have that blind spot. And even having met you and even having played sports where I met people of different like creed and color, even having gone to like USF, which is a very diverse college. And again, like I've never shied away from people that weren't white. Even having done that, even maybe being a little bit further along and a little bit more empathetic than the average white kid from a suburb, I still have blind spots. And I still have not been forced to think about some of the problems that are presenting themselves in this civil rights movement, right? And, you know, that brings up points about education, about what we were taught in our schools, about the history of race in this country. It brings up points about what information is available or easily understood about our current climate and our current budgets. And it brings up a bit about exposure and comfortability and what you see up close and personal when you're me versus when you're Chris versus when you're somebody who's even had less opportunities than me or Chris. And so for me, I guess this journey, this experience in the last couple months, has been just a lot about further education and taking the time to read, taking the time to listen, taking the time to watch documentaries, to learn about a history that I didn't get exposed to in school, to learn about things like redlining, to learn about things like the difference between equity across races in the United States. That's a lot of what this has been for me, and just feeling, trying to feel a deep sense of empathy and understanding. And then you wrap all that up with the nice bow that I'm of the opinion that our democracy is at risk. Like, I think that's a catalyst for a lot of this for me too, because a lot of my personal, like, family history and a lot of my personal inclinations are towards politics and towards philosophy. And if I'm going to take those topics seriously, and I'm going to take this Black Lives Matter movement seriously and try to apply personal ethics to it, we have to talk about the fact that we have leadership in this country and we have a polarized political system that is okay with breaking apart Americans. That's okay with race baiting. That's okay with dismantling a lot of our institutions that are the only way we can ever create equity. So that's really what my journey has been. And all this shit came together in like this nightmare scenario that is 2020. it's been a lot to take in.
Yeah. It's been quite a wild ride. Talking about your experience, you know, kind of not necessarily waking up, but having all these realizations surrounding race and your own privilege, I definitely relate to a lot of that sentiment. You know, becoming a white ally, you know, it's never a mantle that I realized that I would actively have. But it's really important to use that kind of that title of I'm a white ally and I'm actively making steps in my life to be anti-racist and speak up for individuals that I believe are being marginalized like they truly are. I grew up in a similar situation. I did have a blind spot. I was never considered myself a racist, but especially now I'm having all these realizations of these microaggressions or things that I could have done in the past, not actively trying to be a bad person or, you know, hurt anyone, but just realizing, wow, there's so much that I need to learn and correct. And the only way that I'm going to do it as, you know, a white individual that grew up in the South in a little white bubble is educating myself and reading.
Completely agree. I spent a lot of time thinking about my own like past actions, maybe some of the jokes I might have made at the expense of other people, even if I was thinking about them as wordplay or innocent or whatever. You know, I think it's important for people like you and I to reflect on that and realize where we can do better. And I think most people that have lived our experience should be doing that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I'm over here just like snapping my life away. I'm like, these are my friends. Yeah.
Chris, you know what I was thinking about today? And it's funny that this interview is happening today, but you know, I started paying for a bunch of news sources, one of them being the New York Times. And the New York Times ran this article today about Camden, New Jersey. And I started to think about that experience. So for context for the listeners, when Chris and I were in high school, this was actually how I met Chris. Mm-hmm. We went to this Catholic school, and that's funny for me because by the time I was like 14, I was like, nah, I'm definitely agnostic at least and atheist and sometimes maybe somewhere in the middle. And I learned more definitions along the way, but yeah. By the time I was 14 or 15, I was like, this does not make any sense. And nobody's giving me the answers that I need. But
I agree with that for sure. Yeah. And especially now realizing like that kind of feeling that I was having of this is not right. It's because growing up Catholic, it's like, this is an institution with so much corruption, just like our government. It's just, it's not better just because you're doing something in the name of God.
Right. Right. Yeah. It is exactly another example of an institution that should be kept in check. And also, you know, you get down to like the nuts and bolts of why you believe what you believe, and should you put all your faith in a book that was written a very long time ago, 60 years after Jesus died? Should you put all your eggs in that basket? But that's
should
not
you put your eggs in a constitution that was written by all white men.
that is,
if we're gonna go there,
yeah. But I'm gonna reel it back in. I'm gonna reel this thing
real quick. I am
not trying to isolate religious people, because honestly, what we need right now is more good Christians.
Yes.
Like we need more people that follow the gospel. And so more power to you if you're that Christian. But the reason I bring it up is because one of my teachers or guidance counselors encouraged me to go on a mission trip when I was in high school, and obviously that was hilarious to me. But the funny thing about that mission trip, and the salient thing here, is that it was a mission trip to Camden, New Jersey, which is what the fuck were these people thinking? Mm-hmm. But at the time, Camden, New Jersey was like the murder capital of the United States.
Yep,
and I thought that was really intriguing, and I thought going on a mission trip would be funny. And I also was like, you know what? If I'm somebody who is so passionate about endorsing open-mindedness, and if I'm somebody who in my family life is criticizing my close family, my immediate family, about the way that they close themselves off to other opinions, then the least I can do is go on this mission trip and be exposed to other things. I was lucky enough that when I was 15 or 16, that was earnestly the way I was thinking about it. I went on this trip to Camden, and that's where I met Chris. And, you know, if I'm like one end of the spectrum of privilege, honestly, the people at the BMWs with the BMWs in our high school were probably the extreme end. But if I'm on one side of the spectrum of privilege and Chris is somewhere in the middle, the people of Camden, New Jersey at that time were like the absolute low end of luck in this world, right? Mm-hmm. I was 15 years old and watching people do heroin on the side of the road. It was crazy. It was crazy. Like, I had heard gunshots before because I had shot guns before at that time. Like, I was a Boy Scout, but I had not heard guns in the streets before. I had not seen like people like visibly high as fuck, like losing their minds on the side of the road. I had not seen a physical police altercation. I had not seen disabled people or drug addicts that bodies were like falling apart because of like the conditions they lived in. I had seen rampant homelessness. I hadn't seen gang crime. Like, we had somebody like pointed at us as if like they were holding a gun with their hands, right? And I was like a 15-year-old. And so, you know, at the time, I didn't quite understand. I didn't maybe think about how important that was to my perspective as a human. And forming a relationship with Chris, like one of the few Black people that I could have been exposed to at that point in my life, it's just that moment in my life was so critical. And I didn't realize at the time, but reflecting on it, I do. And I think it's hilarious that this article popped up today, because it's talking about how Camden, New Jersey is an example of what police reform looks like in the United States.
Nice.
Yeah. And it was just loaded with so many good bits about how it happened in Camden and the difference between when we were in Camden and what it is today. Like, for example, right now in 2019, Camden had 3 excessive force complaints. In the entire year, right? 18 homicides with firearms. That number is probably higher in Tampa, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And it just talks about the reasons it happened. It talks about the culture and the attitude that was built from scratch, because what Camden did is they dismantled their entire police department and then rebuilt it from the ground up. Mm-hmm. And they hired 2/3 of the police officers back that they fired over time. But really what they did is they disrupted the police union that was protecting shitty behavior. Mm-hmm. And then they had strong leadership that enforced a new methodology, a new training technique, and a focus on, like, quote, the sanctity of life, talking about de-escalation in a meaningful way, talking about community engagement in a meaningful way, talking about the ways in which your officers can avoid punishing petty crimes and instead using those as teaching moments. And I think that it was just this very weird aligning of my life personally and this moment about police violence in this country.
That's so crazy, because I agree. I love to hear that. And I love those concrete examples of how that change is possible, especially in this time period that we're living in. I think another point too is that trip to Camden, just as it was eye-opening for you, it was just as eye-opening for myself in terms of my own privilege, right? Because up until that point, I had grown up in white suburbia, not rich or anything, but my mom and my dad and my parents, like, worked their asses off to ensure that I was able to live in a more affluent community, go to a more affluent school, have opportunities that, like, other people of my race would not likely have, especially in regards to, like, the people of Camden. But I also came from, like, my parents are from Haiti, and they were born and raised in Haiti, and they moved here. And so I grew up Haitian, third world country mindset and perspective. But also, when I left the house, I was American, and I was in abundance and affluence and all these different things. And I was trying to find the balance between where I lived in my house and then the school where 16-year-olds have BMWs. And then also, how I existed as a Black man in America was very different than how I would exist as a Black man in Haiti. And I think Camden, New Jersey trip was the first point where that intersection of Black man in America, Black man in Haiti really came to a culmination, because that's when I realized that I had parents who had offered me a privilege that a lot of other Black people in America do not get. And I got to see it firsthand. And it was an awakening for me as much as it was for the rest of the white kids on that trip. So it's funny that you bring up that story, because it was just as impactful for me in recognizing my own privilege, but also in recognizing how whitewashed my understanding of the Black experience and existence was at the time. And even as I grew up, like, it wasn't until really, like, the past few years that I've started to really come to terms with that whitewashing and understanding that there's a lot of deprogramming that I need to do myself. There's a lot of re-education that I need to do myself. So it's work that we all have to do, because we're working with a system that has been designed to oppress the Black experience, but also continue to allow the white experience to continue that oppression, and sometimes unintentionally, without you even realizing. And it's like you said, like, you had brought up the point about recognizing maybe the jokes that you might have made, or recognizing the little moments here and there. And Kelly brought up the microaggressions and things. It's so baked in that, like, even I was laughing at the Oreo jokes that were made in high school. I was a part of the token jokes that we made in high school, like me being the token Black kid, like all these things. And I laughed at it and I played a part in it, never realizing the impact that it really had. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I love the fact that, like, with Camden, I like that it was both of our awakening in a sense. And then now to see it, like, 10 years later, the change occurred. So it's possible, like, we can do it. We just have to put in the work, which I think is huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
And being active. I think a big part of it, what Camden did, was active engagement. You've been doing a lot of work since this revolution kind of started back in the beginning of June, with, like, protests and city council meetings. One of the things is you went to, like, a city council meeting and you've been reading documentation, all these types of things. But I really want to go into that council meeting and how you've translated your existence now to being more active in your community to try to combat this.
Yeah, the city council meeting was an interesting experience, and it was the first gathering of our local leaders since the protest began. It was early in June, I think. It was like around June 4th or somewhere in that range. So I'd already been to a few protests at that point. And, you know, at those protests, I had seen people get tear gassed for seemingly no reason. I watched people get shot with rubber bullets. I watched like cop cars drive like quickly through crowds of people. Like I remember watching and going, that's way too fast to be driving through human beings. Mm. And after that happened, I watched those cop cars get like things thrown at them. And it was hard for me to be upset at the people throwing things. It's like, you know what, we shouldn't throw things, and that's less productive than not throwing things. Mm. But also, you just got tear gassed and shot with bullets, rubber bullets, and the cop car drove through the crowd at 15 miles an hour, you know? So it's like,
yeah,
I would probably be mad too if the cop was running me over. And so, you know, I watched all that happen. I also saw some seemingly okay cops, like, not be aggressive towards people. I didn't see any police officers shake any hands or take any knees or hold any signs. And I didn't see anything from my leadership, like our local leadership, our mayor, or police department, that would lead me to believe that they were going to do something meaningful in the city. And so, you know, for those reasons, I felt it important to go to the city council meeting. And it was kind of confusing. I was kind of torn about speaking in a way, just because, to the point that I think you made earlier, Chris, this is a time where we should be listening and building up, you know, the Black voices in our communities around us. And I was apprehensive to take the microphone away from somebody. But, you know, fortunately, there was a gap. Like there was room for me to speak. Nobody was standing up in line, and somebody was actively asking me if I wanted to speak. So that's what brought me to the mic. And essentially, in that meeting, one of our local city council members had started his introduction. Like every council member gets a chance to talk at the beginning of the whole meeting and give like a few minutes of an introduction. And the council member started off by, you know, talking about how he definitely condemns the murder of George Floyd. He's with the community. He understands the protesters. He said the right things at first. He wasn't like a, I don't know, he wasn't complete. He didn't have his eyes closed, right? But finished off his statement by saying that all these people at the University Mall and in Tampa, that was where like our real riot happened. A building burned down. There was looting. It was after a protest, late at night at like 11 o'clock at night. And he just like really emphasized that they were all thugs, right? The way he said it, everything was like, these are thugs, right? Anybody who pays attention to anything, it knows that thugs has been used to describe Black people unequivocally for a long time in this country. Mm-hmm. It has been an excuse to execute racial policing. Mm-hmm. Thugs has been a dog whistle used by politicians for years. Like, mm-hmm. This is not opinion that I'm giving right now. This is just understanding the context of the word thug in American cultural and political light. Mm-hmm. And the fact that one of my councilmen said that and like emphasized it told me that he was caught up in that rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And he was fully prepared to de-emphasize the reasons that rioting and looting were happening. Rioting mm-hmm. and looting don't happen if you're happy and taken care of and satisfied and everything's hunky-dory, right?
Right.
And so it caught me off guard. And then the first couple people that got up to speak at the mic, like I'd say 25 people spoke before I spoke. And the first guy that got to the mic was just, he was like yelling into the microphone, essentially saying that thugs, like, we know what that means. It means N-word, right? Like, this mm-hmm. has been used against us forever, right? Mm-hmm. Look at my Black skin. Look at my kid's Black skin. When you say the word thugs, that carries weight, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, after this, like, very passionate, like, angry man was yelling into this microphone, our representative doubled down on the word thugs. He was like, no, I'm just going to call it what it is. That's what they are. They're thugs. They're criminals, mm-hmm. and that's what they are. And he wasn't saying it like he was a racist. He was saying it like he was just totally oblivious as to what that rhetoric meant. In the same week that our president used the word thugs and race baited about the protests, a president who has, during our Ferguson protests, when white nationalists ran people over and there was a large gathering of KKK members, said that there were good people on both sides. Our president called people thugs and then gassed Americans to take a photo shoot at a church, right? Like the same week that happened, this local councilman chose to look a black man in the face who was telling him the gravity of the way that he's thinking about it. There's one thing to be the PC thought police and talk about, like, you can't use that word. But it's another thing to dismiss the relevance of the word in this moment, right?
It was
astounding to me that this person, this elected official, who is a lawyer, a person who studies words, who enforces words, just completely missed this point. And so, you know, that happens. Another like black leader in this community who's now running for elected office. His name's Elvis. It's
Pigeot.
Yeah. He was like so eloquent. He was like, he made so like such a great point. It was so moving that this representative from South Tampa, which is hilarious that he's from South Tampa, which is the white rich part of Tampa, that he actually was like, you know what, Elvis, I respect you. And Elvis didn't yell at him. Elvis didn't call him a monster, right? But he was very firm in saying, you should know better. And before Elvis walked away, the South Tampa rep apologized. And it was good to see. But fast forward here, at this council meeting, I had gone with the intention to voice my opinion that on the docket that day, we needed to be pushing through an economic advisory committee. This economic advisory committee was geared towards creating equal opportunities for minority communities and figuring out the best ways that as a city we can support these marginalized neighborhoods, that's the whole point, right? That is the root of the policing problem. That is the root of the real equity problems in the United States. That's what keeps minorities consistently in lower income brackets and makes the people that rise out of poverty the exceptions, right? And so I went there to voice my opinion that was something that we needed to be pushing through. It was also on the docket that day that we were going to refinance some bonds to be able to fund body cameras in Tampa, 650 body cameras, which for the record, there's 1,200 police officers or 1,200 people under the police budget in Tampa. So half of them get body cameras, or maybe some of them already had them. But I went there to make sure that we were going to pass that, to make sure that the council members knew that the people of Tampa wanted that, because they had previously stripped that funding out and left funding in for tasers. And so I went there to make sure that point was heard and made it clear that the way that South Tampa representative had spoken was unacceptable. And as a white person, we needed to be doing more listening than we were talking. And we needed to be reflecting on what our words and actions meant, and that we need to be pushing through these policies that help to address these issues. And there were some other bits in there about single-use plastics being, really the analogy was, on that docket, we had a budget going towards pandemic relief. We had a proposal to do an analysis of single-use plastics in Tampa, and we had a conversation about money going towards these body cameras. And the last analogy I made was, all of those problems are not obvious to a lot of people, right? Like, we didn't take the pandemic seriously until our neighbors were dying, and we didn't take climate change seriously, and we're still not in a lot of ways. And we're not taking single-use plastic seriously until all of a sudden there's plastic and beads and shit floating around in the bay, and there's pollution in our streets. Like, we're not going to take action until it gets on our pristine South Tampa lawn. And a lot of white people and a lot of people of privilege, whether they're white or not, don't see the injustice in this country that happened to minority communities. And it's all of our responsibility to look outside of ourselves and to do the gosh darn research, right? To try to find the perspectives that are not your own, and then to legislate accordingly. It's unethical to do anything else. So that was what happened at that council meeting. And I guess, Chris, you led us in here talking about, you know, maybe the ways that you can make an impact in your local community. And I didn't go to that meeting anticipating that much drama to occur. But I think it was important for me to say what I said, even if I was apprehensive about it.
Yeah. It's amazing that you are a really, you know, intelligent individual who takes the time and feels the confidence to go into situations like that, that you may be uncomfortable with, but you have the tools to back it up and make an important statement at the time. As a white ally, how do you feel you could give some encouragement, recommendations for people who may not have that confidence or feel comfortable doing actions like you're doing? What are some small, you know, micro activism that you might recommend for people that want to get involved?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think it's about listening. If you don't feel confident doing what I do, and I'm sure that at some point I'm going to say something stupid. Like at some point I'm going to say something I'm going to be missing information, and I'm going to put out a bad opinion or a bad string of words.
Yeah.
But you can't be afraid to do that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we just have silent, complicit people. Mm-hmm. And so I think that one of the most important things that people that are trying to be involved that might not be as brash as I am can do is to listen, and then to promote the voices of people that they respect, to promote the ideas that maybe they didn't make themselves or aren't ready to verbalize at a public forum, but they can at least spread these ideas, and they can start having some of those hard conversations with the people in their lives.
100%. Yeah. I think a huge part of this is recognizing that in that example of that city council leader, right, there was a slew of people who were telling you that the word choice that you were using was a direct negative impact of their lived experience. And you had this guy who, instead of listening, doubled down on his term because he just felt like he was so right. He wasn't listening to, even if it's like the thought police or like PC, like hearing people out is what's important about this movement. And I think that's a huge first step. But also, it's once you've done that and you understand that, Kelly and I were talking about this. I know that you want to bring this up, Kelly, is that how do you, being a white ally, how do you continue to do all these things without drowning out or overshadowing the overall movement with what you're saying? And I want to say, as a Black person, to my white allies and my white friends and everybody, is we as a Black community are going to need the help of our white allies to address and dismantle the centuries worth of white supremacy and systemic racism that exists in this country. And I would rather have you amplifying Black voices, calling out your white friends and family, being vocal in all aspects of your life to continue helping to move that needle. I would rather you shoot as far as you can and potentially overreach, and then you can get told that you were overreaching, than not reach at all, you know? And I think that's something that we can talk about moving forward and how to best have those conversations.
Yeah, right. I definitely have found myself, before I make any kind of statement, I overthink everything because I want to make sure that I'm putting the right amount of thought and I'm educated in the right way before I say anything. But what does that lead me to? Silence. And that's not helping anybody.
You talked about, Kelly, what can white allies do? There's the aspects of what Trey is doing and being more active in your own community, in your local community, in your government, and all that. But there's also the interpersonal relationships too, right? And how can you engage in that? I know, Trey, not only are you doing things out in your community, but part of that is being actively anti-racist within your personal connections. So, Trey, I know there's a little bit of story and background there. Do you want to go into how you've been engaging in that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I think there's a few layers here, right? So there's like my close family, there's my friends, and then there's the business world too.
Yeah.
And those are all in my immediate sphere of influence, right? And so I think that this applies to, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and understanding the role of racism in our country and what the like practical implications are as an American when we think about our economy and when we think about equity and we think about criminal justice and prisons. There are so many things to understand in that regard. I think that also, again, I'm gonna bring this back up. I think that we are living through an exceptional moment in American history, and that Donald Trump is a stress test for our democracy. And I've been pretty cautious against being too extreme when it comes to Donald Trump. In 2016, you know, he was the outlaw candidate, right? He was somebody that was going to come in and just totally mess up a broken system. And, you know, I wouldn't have villainized his supporters then. I would have thought that they were really questionable to be endorsing a man that thinks he can grab people by the pussy, that thinks that condemned innocent black men in Central Park, that has bankrupted six businesses, a person who openly talked about how great of friends he was with Jeffrey Epstein, who, you know, like the list is innumerable for the reasons that Donald Trump is immoral. But in 2016, I would have thought that you were probably voting Republican after 8 years of a Democrat. And I probably would have thought that you were just really dissatisfied with our current political system. And you know what? As somebody who was fiercely independent until Bernie Sanders came along, I totally get being fiercely dissatisfied with our political system. So for me, to reel this back to the question you asked is how does this manifest in my friends and my family and my business life? Well, it's a two-front war, I guess. I don't even want to call it a war because that implies too much aggression. It's two-front activism. One, I need to be having conversations about systematic racism in this country, systemic racism in this country, and what we can proactively do to solve those problems. And two, I need to be talking to the people in my life that are caught up in the Trump cult. I don't know any other way to think about it, truthfully. I've not met a very intelligent person who is also like ethical, who thinks that Trump is a good person. I know so many Republicans that are actively not going to vote for Donald Trump, and I applaud those people. Those are the bravest people in this moment to me. The people that have lived in our like two-party polarized system that maybe carry some beliefs that land on the conservative side of the spectrum, that have an identity in conservatism and maybe Christian values are associated with that, but are still bold enough and brave enough to look past that party line to not support Donald Trump, who is none of their Christian values. Like Donald Trump does not embody Christian values in any way. And he's somebody who is showing, if we look at history, every sign of a fascist. Like if we look at the way that Stalin rose to power, if we look at Vladimir Putin, if we look at Kim Jong-un, if we look at Hitler, even if we look at a lot of the communist revolutions in Eastern Europe, we see the same behaviors. And again, that's not opinion. Like I'm not trying to be political. I'm trying to be historical. And so I applaud those people. And so anyway, in my personal life, my family has always been divided politically. My mother was somebody who was passionate about her points, somebody who was reasonably well-informed. I mean, you don't work at NPR and not consume a lot of content about political issues. And my dad was the total opposite, right? My dad went to the strictest military college in the United States, where they would punch you in the forehead with a brass ring if you didn't swear allegiance to Ronald Reagan, right? That is not exaggeration. That is reality, right? That happened and it's written about. There are books about it, right? Yeah. And he's somebody that listened to Rush Limbaugh when I was a kid for a long time. He has conservative proclivities because he was taught them. And I'm sure he believes some of them to an extent. But I think more than anything, in my experience, I've watched my dad consume a lot of extreme content, and not read a lot of books and not read a lot of long form articles and not read a lot of research, economics or science. I've watched him consume TV and radio talk shows and now a lot of memes on Facebook. And I don't know, that's just something I've been thinking about since I was a little kid. It really bothered me a lot when I was really young. And so for me, in this moment, when we're talking about racism and we're talking about democracy, I think it's important to draw lines in the sand mm-hmm. with your family members. And for me, that's not just my dad. That's some of my extended family, too. That goes to business. You know, I've had some hard conversations at my job with our executive leadership about our decisions to be silent through both the pandemic and the civil rights movement. And with my friends, it manifests in trying to figure out the right ways to be vocal and when and how to approach these topics in a way that isn't going to promote outrage and anger like everything else in this world right now, mm-hmm. and instead is going to bring people together and show some shared humanity and convince people that their votes and their everyday actions matter and affect other people.
Yep.
Yeah. Oof. I love all that. Yeah. Cause I'm experiencing a lot of anxiety. I'm going to be visiting my family soon. And some parts of my family are very conservative. Some are more liberal and they all have very strong opinions about what's going on in our country, the president, Black Lives Matter movement. And I want to have constructive conversations with them that aren't going to galvanize them even more in their conservative opinions. You know, I have a cousin that fiercely loves Donald Trump, like calls him Uncle Don.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering how I'm going to have that kind of conversation with him, or even if it's going to come up at all, which it might not. But yeah. There's been so many times where, you know, other members of our family have tried to talk and it divides us even more than it should. Yeah. You know, because people are coming out of a place of defense and mm-hmm. and they just like digging their heels in mm-hmm. when it's all coming out of a place of love and we just want to help each other grow.
Oh, so. Yeah, I completely agree. I think that you've made a couple good points there that I think is the key to like answering your question about how you're going to do this. Mm-hmm. The first one I think is actively recognizing that you think, if you do think this, the person you're talking to is a good person. Yeah. You know, for me, for example, like I have my dad, one of my other relatives and some other people in my friend group, they're good people. Like they're not monsters. My dad's not a Nazi, you know, like mm-hmm. he's not actively racist. He doesn't think you should run over protesters. You know, he doesn't want to hurt anybody. And if I villainize him, or if I villainize some of my more conservative friends or my executive team at my company, if I villainize them, it accomplishes nothing, right? Mm-hmm. It proves to them that I'm an unreasonable liberal that is just, you know, some extreme person, when really I barely identify with the word liberal, right? I'm just a person that is pretty informed on some of these things and would love to have a conversation with you about it and convince you that your decisions here matter a lot. And so yeah. I think step one is, if you don't think they're monsters, tell them that, like, be like, listen, you're like, I think you're a good person. Right. And I think that goes a long way. And hopefully it doesn't come across as condescending.
I think really quick, sorry, yeah, I'm just going to, so one of the books that I'm reading right now is called White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. And one of the things that she brings up is this concept of good and bad when it comes to the conversation of systemic racism and everything that's going on and how it's a fallacy and it's an excuse that we can hide behind. So I think what's important, and you're kind of talking about it, Trey, is that helping them to see that when it comes to systemic racism, it's not a conversation of like whether you're a good person or a bad person. It's that systemic racism exists. And here's mm-hmm. all the ways that it exists. And here's all the ways that you continue to perpetuate it, or how it's continued to be perpetuated. And it has nothing to do with whether you're a good or bad person. It's the facts of it all. And we need to acknowledge yeah. that outside of who you think you are in your identity character and your value. And it's like, it's step away from that. You can be a good person and still be racist. You can be a bad person and still be racist. Racism exists outside of that concept. So I want to preface that, but to your point, I think it's also good to, you're recognizing that it's riddled in all these layers that they've been spoon-fed to build and formulate their identities and their sense of self-worth. So to have that conversation, you need to make sure that they recognize that you're not attacking their identity. You're not attacking who they are as a person, but more so like what they've consumed to form that identity. And maybe there's different things that you can consume to help you reformulate that understanding. So just want to press.
I couldn't agree with that more. And I think another important thing to add to that is you, as in like me or Kelly or anybody else that might feel the way that we've clearly expressed we feel in this podcast, have to be willing to do what you're asking the other person to do, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to receive the information they're trying to tell you. Mm-hmm. You have to be willing to engage with it and honestly reflect and be introspective and see if maybe you have bias. Mm-hmm. Because if you're not willing to do that, how could you ever expect the other person to do that? Mm-hmm. Because the truth is, everybody's been spoon-fed something, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, are you willing to spit it out?
Yeah. Yep.
And so,
I love that.
Yes.
And so I think that's a really important thing. But Kelly, to get to the second thing that I think you mentioned that's really important for anybody who's trying to have a hard conversation like this, regardless of what you believe, what side you think you're on, don't fucking do it at a dinner table. Like, don't do it in front of other people, because like you said, it makes somebody dig their heels in, puts them on the defensive. It opens you up to the peanut gallery. Like, I have a lifetime. I have a lifetime of experience, and it's a pretty short one, of experience watching and trying to provide concrete points to my mother and father. And then right when I think that I'm making a salient point that's backed by data, that isn't biased, that isn't me trying to condemn anybody, either my dad will come at my mom being like, yeah, told you so, haha. Or my mom will come up my dad being like, yeah, you fucking idiot. And so it's like, in those moments, nobody wins. Because when you open it up to the peanut gallery that's going to use your words as affirmation of their own identity and their own bias, you're going to put the other person on the defensive. So I would recommend that it happens one-on-one. And then the third thing is, I would recommend you figure out a way to make it happen with you not even being in the room. You give that person a book, you give that person an article, you give that person a documentary where they, in their own quiet moment, have the opportunity to reflect without anybody there to call them an idiot.
Oh, wow. I love that advice. That's great.
And then to that last point too, and then you follow up with them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because you can give it to them and then what have they done with it? So offering them these opportunities for them to investigate these things on their own terms, but then holding them accountable is just as powerful as being like, hey, have you watched that documentary, or bring up a question about it? And if they say, oh, they haven't already, like, continue that dialogue about it so that you push them towards doing that thing, because you providing them that resource is nothing if they don't utilize it, right? So part of that activism is also just, I provide that resource and then I hold you accountable to you actually consuming that resource.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome.
It's just, I think that maybe some things that I think tie into this is, that's all well and good. So now what is the information? For my people in Tampa, you know, let me just say this to you and you tell me if it makes any sense. We spend $9.6 million on affordable housing in Tampa, but all of that comes from grants that we win. None of it comes from our internal revenue, right? Does that make sense?
Hmm.
Right. If we know that a huge part of crime is associated with home ownership, right? It's associated with housing and stability and income and what you have to do to afford basic necessities. Does it make sense that we spend none of our tax dollars on affordable housing?
Hmm.
Let me add another thing. We spend $5 million on a golf course fund that maintains 3 golf courses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the best use of our money when our arts funds and our conservation funds don't even reach $500,000?
You're telling me the city of Tampa spends money on golf courses?
$5 million a year. The golf course fund comes from the capital budget, which is a little bit different from the general budget. the general budget is mostly driven by property tax, right? But the golf course fund and the capital budget comes from a lot of the revenue that they either generate from those, from some of the institutions, maybe some grant money that they might have won that they can allocate. But it is money that the city controls nonetheless. And from that same capital budget, there are a bunch of programs that have to do with equity, that have to do with the arts, that have to do with conservation, that have to do with community empowerment. And instead, we're spending that money on golf courses. So, yeah, it's pretty crazy. Some other
you
things
can't see my face right now, but it is cracked. Drop some more knowledge. Come on.
Here's some more. If we look at full-time employees in the city of Tampa, the Tampa Police Department has 1,241. The fire department has 750. The HR department has 36. The arts department has 2. The minority and small business development department has 6. The mayor's department has 7, right? The mayor's office has more employees than the minority and small business development department, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely mind-blowing to think about. And here's the last one. The PR, the public affairs department, has 12. Just blows my mind. For the Tampa people, that's something worth considering. And I think maybe a little bit more broadly for some of these other people that might be listening that maybe aren't Tampa natives. I think that maybe one thing I want to say is if you are confused about these protests, if you're confused about people actively pushing against somebody like Donald Trump, who has gutted our institutions, who has undermined truth in the press, and has actively sown division in this country, I think it's worth considering that the foundations of our country, the primarily American thing that we have, is people pushing back against tyranny, right? The reason that this country was founded was because there were people that were dissatisfied with the way that they were being governed elsewhere. And so in that way, it is very important, and it is an American thing to do, to consider history when we have internal conflict in our country. The systems that have been put in place in America are not there to protect us from the Chinese or from, you know, immigrants. The Constitution and the checks and balances that are there don't reflect American superiority. They're there to mitigate the consequences of our imperfections, right? Mm. The reason that our democracy was formed and the reason that we have a House and a Senate and the executive branch and a separation of church and state is because our founding fathers understood the human risks that we run when we organize. Mm-hmm. And so for us to have a superiority complex is blind, right? It's missing the reason why we're a country in the first place. And we shouldn't pretend that we're perfect or that we're great. We should be applauding the protesters or the activists or the voices that are challenging something that they see as corrupt, because that is what it means to be American. So I want to talk about what we can do as people. And I think that's one of the most important things we can take away.
Okay, so you ready for some rapid fire questions, Trey?
Loosey goosey, right. Line it up.
Cool. Kelly, you want to start it off?
Yes. All right. Number one, least favorite type of music?
Pop country.
Ooh. Okay.
Not country's country music's cool. There's a lot of really cool country music, but pop country is.
Yep.
It is just the worst. My God.
I love it. Okay. All right, next question. One food you wouldn't want to give up?
Oh, man. Penang.
Ooh.
Ooh. You went real exotic.
I have a love affair with
he Penang. Really does. He really does.
That dang Penang.
I love it.
All right. Favorite cartoon show growing up?
Tough. Growing up. When does growing up stop?
Good point.
Maybe favorite cartoon now?
favorite cartoon now is BoJack Horseman, no questions asked.
Love.
Favorite cartoon then?
In your adolescence.
I was definitely a big Ed, Edd n Eddy guy.
Yes.
I loved Rurouni Kenshin.
Ooh.
That's a deep cut for you.
That is a deep cut.
I'll leave it at that.
All right, cool. All right. What do you think of when I say the word fruit?
The first thing that came to my mind was banana.
We do eat a lot of bananas here at the house. So,
yeah.
Love them. All right. Hard or soft?
Soft.
Okay. So. Favorite emoji?
Oh, man. My favorite emoji is probably the salsa dancer.
Ooh, nice.
She's a mysterious one.
She really is. So many questions.
All right. So here is our big one. What are you grateful for right now?
I'm grateful that none of my family members are in jail and none of them have been assaulted by police officers and none of them have been shot on a routine stop and that we all have the opportunity to do something about it.
Wow.
Hell yeah.
That's a good thing.
Hell yeah. All right.
We all have the opportunity to do something about it. So.
Heck yeah. And that segues perfectly into our something to steep on. So Trey had sent this over to us earlier. And so his takeaway for you all and for us is this quote by Timothy Snyder. And it says, "Life is political, not because the world cares about how you feel, but because the world reacts to what you do. The minor choices we make are themselves a kind of vote, making it more or less likely that free and fair elections will be held in the future. In the politics of the everyday, our words and gestures, or their absence, count very much." Love it. God, that's powerful. That's powerful. And I think it wraps up our entire conversation today.
Absolutely.
Perfectly. All right, Trey.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you, buddy. Kisses. All right, man. Thank you. We appreciate your time. And I'm sure you'll be back on here next time. So,
right on. Thanks for having me, guys.
Keep absolutely. Doing what you're doing. Thank you so much for listening to today's episodes. For more information on this episode, check out the show notes and find us on Instagram at stillsteepingpod, spelled STILLSTEEPINGPOD.
If you love what you just listened to or know somebody who would, please share it. Simply screenshot today's episode in your podcast app and share it with your friends and family, as well as to your Instagram stories. And don't forget to tag us.
And if you'd like to lend your personal support to the podcast, take a moment to like or leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen.
And last but not least, Still Steeping is produced by Kelly DeVinny and Chris Lewis. Original music created by Matt Vaughn and logo and designs created by Trey Steinhoff.
Tune in next week for the next cup. And until then,
stay steeping.